On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The GabFest is sponsored by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer, and have your postal carrier pick up your packages. Sign up for a no-risk trial and get $55 in free postage when you visit Stamps.com and use the promo code GabFest. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political GabFest for October 3rd, 2014, the Jump the Fence edition. I'm David Plotz, the editor-at-large of Slate. I'm in Washington, D.C. On this week's show, why is President Obama being protected by mall cops? We'll try to figure that out. Then, is Mitt Romney actually a credible candidate for president in 2016, or is this just some elaborate prank pulled by a few people in the chattering classes? And then the weird Kansas Senate race, in which a guy who will not say what he believes could tip the Senate toward the Democrats, since they're going to lose everything else everywhere else. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter and a great Slate Plus segment today. Wow, it's a good Slate Plus segment. I just listened to it. I'm about to launch this podcast where I interview people about their jobs. And today we're gonna tease it with an interview with Stephen Colbert, bits of my interview with Stephen Colbert, in which he talks about how he gets himself into character as Stephen Colbert. It's a fantastic segment. It's a really, really interesting. He's such a good talker. And you can listen to that if you're a Slate Plus member, which you can become if you go to slate.com/GabFestPlus, or if you email me directly, david.plotz@slate.com. I will hook you up with the best discount. Emily Bazelon is with us in New York, and you are now a New York Times reporter. We can officially say that, right? New York Times Magazine
right.
Reporter?
Exactly. Staff writer.
What did they do to you to initialize you?
I had a really charming meeting with the Newspaper Guild people on my first day on Monday, which I didn't actually quite understand that I am now a member of the Guild, kind of whether I like it or not, but I'm happy to be in the Guild. And what I'm trying to remember is whether I was in the Guild 20 years ago when I first was a newspaper reporter. I can't remember whether I joined.
Now you get like incredible retirement benefits because they would count
right.
you as having.
Did they sign you up or are you just a member of the Guild? There's always that distinction between those who are free riders.
They gave me a card to sign up in which it was the date still had the 19 in it. Like, the year. Isn't that awesome?
That is so.
I think that is a metaphor. That is the best metaphor
so
for,
awesome.
For unions in this country that I've ever heard.
That's,
wow.
That's fantastic.
But I sent it back nonetheless.
I hope you're paying. You're not going to be a free rider, are you?
Yeah, no, of course. I have to pay whether I want to officially join or not. I am joining. I am paying. I'm doing all of that. Yeah.
Wait, you have to pay whether you're officially joining or not? Or is
yeah,
this
we
card
talked
check?
About yeah, this yeah, in yeah. our union right. segment about the Supreme Court. You have to pay because you are getting the benefits of collective bargaining
right.
if you're a worker.
Yeah, okay.
Well, congratulations on your new job. So look for great Bazelon stories in the New York Times Magazine.
Thank
coming
you.
Soon. And John Dickerson.
Not that you haven't been able to find them there before.
That's true. Now there'll be even more of them and even better, possibly. John Dickerson is here in Washington. He is Slate's chief political correspondent, political director of CBS News. Hello, John.
Hi, David.
We've got so many great live shows coming up. No matter where you live in this country, there's a great live show coming up for you. So this weekend, on Sunday, we'll be doing our live show in San Francisco, the Super Fest West. That is now that is sold out. And then on November 12th in Chicago, we're going to do a live show. You can get tickets for that at slate.com/ChaiGabFest. It's at the Park West. Ask Amy. Amy Dickinson is going to be our special guest. It is our conundrum show. It is the funnest show of the year. It's really fun live. You'll get to ask awesome questions. John Dickerson will morally struggle. He will wrestle with himself. He will get sweaty wrestling with himself morally. That's going to be a great show. Slate.com/ChaiGabFest. And then on November 17th, just a few days later, in New York, we have our second Superfest. John? Superfest East in New York at the Williamsburg Hall of Music, or the Music Hall of Williamsburg, or the Williamsburg Hall Music, something like that. Tickets for that are at slate.com/superfesteast. Those tickets go on sale at noon on Friday. And for all – and that's a show we're going to do with the Culture Fest, with Mike Pesca, and with the Hang Up and Listen guys. It's going to be amazing. For all these tickets, you, if you're a Slate Plus member, you get 30% off. So please go slate.com/chai-gabfest or slate.com/superfesteast. The Secret Service scandal, a comic opera of incompetence, climaxed on Wednesday with the resignation of Julia Pearson as director. Pearson, who gave one of the least impressive congressional testimonies in history earlier in the week, fell on her sword because of revelations about a series of Secret Service screw-ups, from lying about the White House fence jumper, in addition to just the mere incompetence of handling the White House fence jumper, to a news of a gun-toting weirdo who rode an elevator with President Obama recently, to revelations that the Secret Service didn't notice when someone shot up the White House a few years ago. Whoops, we didn't realize those were gunshots. At least there don't seem to be any more Colombian hookers. So, Emily, there's so much to get in with this.
How can you even resist starting with yourself, since this is your favorite topic and you have been looking for ammunition to go after the Secret Service with
He's been looking for ammunition while the Secret Service hasn't been.
Yeah, they'll probably, now that you've said that, they'll probably come arrest you. That's the kind of confidence.
David, you better not tell me that you're going to suddenly start defending them.
Can I just say one thing about this? So the fence jumper at the White House, in every article it says, who had 800 rounds of ammunition in his car. It was in his car.
It was in his car.
Like, it's his car. He was caught with, like, a pocket knife.
Yes.
This
gets me so mad. Yeah. I want to get into this very thing, which is that people talk about this as though, really, the president's security is being compromised every second. None of these incidents, except possibly the guy with the concealed weapon.
The elevator guy.
Possibly. Is the president's security even remotely compromised? And people are treating this as though there's a nuclear missile headed toward the White House and the president, you know, has 1 minute to get away.
I'm not defending the Secret Service.
I think the ground he's trying to find is the ground I've been trying to find over the last couple of days, which is...
the reasonable person ground.
I will not be on that ground. It's the, yes, it's incompetent, but, like, let's have a sense of perspective here. Right. I mean... You know, okay, you had the fence jumper, but he had a little knife. The president was out of town. He didn't get that far in the building. And also, by the way, if they'd lit him up while he was going across the lawn, we'd all be going on and on about how an Iraqi war vet had been, you know, shot full of holes at the White House.
Yeah, and also probably they would have hit, you know, other people, the protesters behind them on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like a quiet glen. It's a place full of people where you don't just go firing off rounds willy-nilly.
I think willy-nilly is the new head of the
No, willy-nilly. Yeah.
Or maybe that was the one they brought in after the Colombian hookers. So the range of criticisms of the Secret Service for this stuff seems to be, wow, they're incompetent because they've been so underfunded, so we need to give them a ton more money and they'll become better, to, wow, they're incompetent because they're underfunded, so we should give them a lot, even more than a ton more money. There doesn't seem to be any range beyond, like, let's give them a ton more money so they can paramilitarize Washington even more than they have.
Right. I mean, also, just in terms of seeking, like, perspective and balance and judgment here, as we talked about, the guy on the elevator does seem to be the problem, not just because it's probably not great to have a thrice-convicted assaulter carrying a weapon that you don't know about in a closely confined space with the president. I mean, a human being is not allowed to get near the president, let alone some guy who's like a local security guard who's concealing a weapon. I mean, that does seem to be a huge breach. And one other part of this is that when that breach happened, they didn't tell the president it had happened. And yet the director of the Secret Service claimed that she always told the president about when there had been lapses like that. You can agree that that was crappy management on her part, and that there's a culture of ass covering in the Secret Service that seems to me to be separate and apart from these three instances, and may in fact not even be connected to them.
Emily, Secret Service gets $1.8 billion a year in government funding. Are they underfunded?
I was amazed there are 6,600 of them. I mean, we're supposed to be worried that there used to be 6,900, but when I read that number, I thought maybe it had an extra zero on the end, because it just seemed like a lot of people. I mean, obviously they have an important job and we have to respect that. But when you read that the White House didn't have an automatic lock on the front door, it's hard to see how a lot more money is the problem, as opposed to just a kind of smarter way of doing this job that makes use of basic technology. which they also didn't have, like, sensors for the front lawn. I mean, there seemed like a lot
of
basic
things. They
have
so much technology. Those guys have way, way too much technology. I will tell you the problem with the Secret Service in a nutshell.
Good, tell us.
Okay, the problem with the Secret Service is not that they're incompetent, although they may well be incompetent, and they seem to have been grotesquely incompetent in at least a couple of these cases. The problem with the Secret Service is that they are unaccountable to anybody because they exist in this netherworld where – and especially now they've been put in, under the Department of Homeland Security, where it is not possible to question what they do.
But I thought that made them more questionable and that actually they had more autonomy in Treasury, and that's right. An argument for moving them back to Treasury.
No, no. So I think that that's a separate point. I guess my point about Homeland Security, the thing that's happened with Homeland Security is that you're not allowed to question those expenses. There's nothing is ever put up against a rational cost-benefit calculation.
No line item.
You get to do whatever you want and sort of say, like, oh, we really need this. We really need, you know, to train spiders to detect bombs. We need robot spiders everywhere, and we need $16 billion for our robot spider program. It will defend the homeland. You're like, okay, we guess we need robot spiders. I feel that the Secret Service is one big robot spider, is that it is a black box. We have no idea. Do they have enough people to protect the president? Probably. Are they spending the money well? We don't know. And they can just go and just bullshit their way through it because no one is going to be the person who stands up and says, you know what, maybe we shouldn't protect the president. Maybe the fact that the President Obama has had three times as many threats against him just shouldn't make us super anxious. We should just say, we're okay, we're going to do a pretty good job, and that's sufficient. Because at any stage, anything that anyone wants to add, you cannot be the person that says, oh, don't add it. Don't put the machine gun nest on the roof. Don't.
But David,
don't
Congress
train the
dogs. Is seriously on it this time. I mean, they thrashed the former Secret Service director who just stepped down. They thrashed Julia Pearson in these hearings. Now they have a new interim director. Isn't this the moment where there would be some congressional oversight?
But the way the oversight will be is like, you should just do more. The oversight is going to be, it's a maximalist oversight. It's only more. There's no sort of like, let's really think about this and apply some sort of rationality to it in the way that we have tried to apply rationality to all other kinds of programs.
Well, we've tried and failed in many instances. But the fact that they are autonomous and can't be and are held unaccountable, it has not been improved by the accountability we're seeing right now, which is, as you said, the reaction is shoot more and
it's Department of Hysteria.
And now it's going to be even worse, right? Because anything in the future when they ask for money, they'll just say, well, you know, look at what happened when we didn't have the money before. I want to ask you this question, though, which is that some people have tried to make the claim that as a political matter, this will make people feel ever more the fact that Washington is screwed up, can't get anything right, that government is a mess. What do you think about that, A? Do you think people will feel that way? And B, do you feel like it will be a lasting burr under the saddle for them?
I think A is absolutely true, but it's really a short technical advantage for the Republicans who are able to do – this is a wonderful episode for Republicans because it reinforces their basic theme, which is that Washington is kind of incompetent, the government's incompetent, Obama's a bad manager. At the same time, it allows them to appear to be really, you know, deeply concerned, as probably they are,
patriotic
and concerned with the safety of the president. It's a lovely position to be in, and I bet – I haven't looked at the polling data, but John, I'm sure, is about to whip it out. All evidence shows that this is probably accruing to the benefit of Republicans as far as 14 goes.
Well, I don't know. I don't think anybody's done polling on it yet. I think it's irrelevant. Since she resigned and they've got a new head of the Secret Service, unless the Post comes up with another amazing story – I think it's come and gone and totally will be forgotten, as opposed to, say, the VA scandal or the IRS.
The VA scandal, totally forgotten.
Well, there are a lot of veterans to whom it's still important, because I was having this discussion with somebody yesterday about the political implications. And I mean, this isn't, as opposed to the VA scandal, where there are veterans who do vote in important battleground states and people who feel strongly about veterans, whether they have relation to them or have served themselves. In this case, people don't want the president to be shot, but this isn't affecting them in their daily lives. So I think it has actually no impact even on the question of Washington incompetence, which is basically people are at a very low level of confidence in Washington's ability to get anything right. This will affirm and confirm what they previously believed. I don't think it adds new members to the ranks of those who think Washington's incompetent. And I think it goes away and is already away by the time people are listening to this.
I just want to make my point, which I make every time I hear the word Secret Service, as a native Washingtonian, someone who has spent most of my life here, is that the way that we have become an armed garrison in this city And the Secret Service is not entirely responsible for it. There's a lot that's post 9/11, which is all kinds of securitization and garrisoning. But our president travels like the head of a totalitarian regime travels. He travels at that level of threat level, the way public safety officials treat the public when there's any person of importance around is grotesque. The level of bullying, of intimidation, of screaming at, of general treating you as not as a citizen who has a right to be on a public place and to see your public officials, but as someone who is an imminent threat is disgusting. And I hate living – it's one of the things I really hate about what's happened in Washington. And the Secret Service is the most offensive in this way, but in no way unique. But they are the most offensive. And the way they treat people is grim.
But, David, don't we have to worry about the fact that there have been three times as many death threats towards Obama as previous presidents? I mean, I do have this fear that we've given comfort to the –
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's any – of course, when I say this, then the Secret Service people will come back and say what I'm about to say. They'll say, well, you just – we can't tell you about this. But I sincerely doubt there's been any threat to the president, which was an actual threat where, like, really anyone could have gotten away. This guy jumping the fence, there is no chance – the president is more likely to catch Ebola than for this guy to have killed the president.
Well, especially since he left in an helicopter before the guy arrived.
Yeah, I mean, it's just – it's crazy to say that because there are a lot of racists and people who hate Obama out there and who are saying nasty things about him, that really he is in much more danger, in such much more danger that every citizen on the street who is walking needs to be, you know, threatened by a Secret Service officer when they happen to walk out in the street, when they've shut the entire Washington downtown so Joe Biden can drive his stupid 25-car motorcade through downtown in rush hour. It's nuts. It's awful.
I think – well, the motorcades are ridiculous. I think that that the Secret Service and one of the things they're being criticized for here, I think the Secret Service does try to keep that balance, particularly in protecting the First Lady and the president's kids, try to not have a huge footprint. I think part of what they're doing, though, also is that they're anticipating the kind of outrage we're seeing right now, which is like if they don't protect him for all the reasons you would want to protect him from a security standpoint, you'll get this kind of overly done outrage, which affects like your ability to operate even in a reasonable way, you know? So the Secret Service may be deciding to cover him to whatever level, but the political system is encouraging them in every possible way to overdo it.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know why the Secret Service makes me so mad. They really do. That doesn't mean I want a visit from you, Secret Service. Just saying. The GabFest this week is sponsored by Stamps.com. Do not let going to the post office cut down on your free time. You should use Stamps.com instead. With Stamps.com, you can print postage right from your desk. You will not have to go to the post office to find parking and wait your turn. Stamps.com turns your PC or Mac into your own personal post office. You can buy and print official U.S. postage using your computer and printer. You can print everything from stamps to shipping labels whenever you need it, and you can just hand it to your postal carrier. Stamps.com is convenient and easy to use, and you will never waste time going to the post office again. Right now, use our promo code GABFEST for a special offer, a no-risk trial, and a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. For all the details of the special offer and to sign up today, go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GABFEST. That's Stamps.com. Enter GABFEST. Mitt Romney hasn't completely ruled out a presidential run in 2016, maybe. In this period of Republican presidential soul searching in this kind of no man's land, what's it called, where you wait in
Twilight period.
Twilight, but no, in what's it called in Catholic doctrine, the place where
purgatory
before the presidential campaign starts. Romney's name is being bruited about by a few people as a potential candidate for 2016. The reason for this seems to be that there's a field where the obvious establishment candidates, namely Chris Christie and Jeb Bush, have distinct weaknesses. Chris Christie, Bridgegate, and his general temperamentalness. Jeb Bush, his brittleness, his reluctance to run, and positions that appear to be anathema to many in his party. And the conservative firebrand candidates, who are many and enthusiastic, seem risky to many people. So Romney brings a certain gravity. But John Dickerson, you've thought about this a lot. Why are people looking at him now? And is this a serious look, or is this just like a Tinder flirtation?
Well, I think the reason people are looking at him now, there are several different reasons. One is some of the things that Romney said during the campaign, particularly about the strategic threat of Russia, about what was happening in Syria, have turned out to be true. And he was dismissed sort of thoroughly by both the president and Joe Biden. And so there's a lot of just sort of enjoyment from Republicans saying, like, you know, stuffing that back in the president's face. So that's one part of it. I think the other part of it is there's also a lot of people who supported Romney who were embarrassed after he lost and thought, oh, what an embarrassing campaign, particularly people who raised money for him and who felt like with around their friends like, oh, yeah, sorry, I like got you to write that check. And it was such an embarrassing campaign. Now that he's had a rebirth and people in a CNN poll by a pretty good margin, by almost double digits, people say they would vote for Romney over Obama now. Polls in among Republicans in Iowa and other places pick Romney first. Now, those people who supported him, who felt embarrassed about supporting him, can now again kind of be like, hey, Romney, so that it revives their own reputation within their own circles. That has nothing to do with Romney running again, but to the extent that he's seen as a person who might be viable to run again, it sort of elevates him and all who were associated with him. And then I think there's a feeling that like he would be a better president too when there's mismanagement at everything from the VA to the Secret Service to just the idea that basically they can't do anything right in the executive branch. And here's a guy who was an executive who was a turnaround guy. But how you may have fared as a president, which is sort of the imagined perfection of a Romney presidency versus the reality of the Obama presidency. First of all, that itself is kind of obviously a false reasoning. But secondly, even if you imagine him to be a great president, you still have to deal with the fact that he wasn't a great candidate. And if the idea is that the current field of candidates is weak, with which I have some disagreement, he would be a weak candidate, too. So it's not like he is the platonic ideal of a candidate. He would be just as damaged as all those other people you mentioned.
Is it conceivable that he will run, or this is pure fiction?
Anything's conceivable. I think he is mindful of it because when he was a candidate, there were people always looking for other candidates. So he knows the way this works, which is that people look at the current crop of candidates and say, oh, they're, you know, not a perfect thing. So I'll try and promote the candidacy of a person who's not running because that seems like they might be a perfect candidate. There's this just sort of crazy making thinking that happens in both parties. But on the other hand, when people are calling you on the phone and telling you you should run, it's really powerful. And also, as our friend Mark Leibovich wrote this week, Romney feels, and other losing candidates have talked about this and feel this way, this interesting, and we should put a name to it, and I'm surprised Mark didn't. It's not phantom presidency syndrome, but there is a kind of glumness and mild depression that kicks in when you think of like, look at where the country's gone. I could have done something to fix that. And because I lost my campaign, things are going poorly in the country. And they feel
nobody returns my phone calls or wants to have anything to do with me.
That's not happening to him. He's very sought after on the campaign trail. He can write and appear on any show he wants to. The fundraising committees that are raising money for Republican candidates are sending out lots and lots of emails under his name, which matters because what they're trying to do is get people who've given already to open up their emails, and they're more likely to open an email from Mitt Romney than any other Republican luminary at the moment, or not any other, but certainly he's a major contender. So he isn't going through that depressing part of it. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. He's got all these people who feel bullish about him again, and that is encouraging. But I think in the end, I mean, if he is a long-term business thinker and recognizes the trends and not the sort of whiff of the moment, he would have to decide that he could do it again, but it would be just as brutal as before, and there's no guarantee of success.
Emily, John sniffed at this a minute ago. Is this a weak GOP presidential field, or is this just a moment where people are going through the kind of anxiety, if you're a Republican, about, well, we don't have anyone who has the stature of Clinton? Or is it for sure true that they're weak?
Well, they don't have a shoe-in, but that could end up being a strength for them because they could end up having a feisty set of primaries in which Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Chris Christie and maybe Jeb Bush battle it out, and the best candidate emerges from that field and turns into a stronger candidate. So it seems to me like they may feel like Clinton is way ahead at the moment, but they could very easily catch up and overtake her. And to me, Romney is like yesterday's lunch times three, and I can't really imagine it playing out in his favor. I would think that protecting his own reputation, eventually he would be more worried about being a third-time loser than feeling like it's really possible that he's going to win.
He's also old, right? He would be.
He's old. He's 67
yeah,
now,
he's as old as, old as Hillary, so that advantage would be lost. And also, John, I mean, I'm sure this is the point you're about to make. This is going to be a phenomenally strong Republican presidential field. These guys are so smart.
I agree. This is one thing that just like floors me is that there's this feeling that because there's not a front runner, that it's a weak field. In other words, there's not one like anointed candidate. When there's one anointed candidate, you could argue, in fact, I think I do, that that means it's a weak field. I mean, a weak field means you have multiple strong candidates. That may not mean it's going to produce the best possible candidate. That doesn't mean each one is fantastic. But I mean, you've got like five or six governors who are thinking about running.
Who are all smart.
And all smart. You know, John Kasich's about to win Ohio by 20 points. Ohio,
right. He's crucial. Look formidable.
Yeah, a crucial state. And then you've got other people. I mean, you've got Rob Portman, who is, you know, maybe he's not going to like change the world in with his charisma. But I mean, he is a durable, reasonable senator. And if you look at the past in past races, I mean, look, going back even back to 1980, you never had such a field with so many possibilities in it. You had maybe one strong candidate, but then you had a bunch of other kind of also-rans. There's never been a group of thinker of those who are on the sidelines thinking about getting in who meet a bunch of the serious tests. Also, just one other thing is that, you know, when Ronald Reagan ran in 76 and 80, there were plenty of people who treated him basically the way people are treating Rick Perry now, which is like big dummy, like an actor as president. Never. Like totally laughed and joked about him as a
You mean we can't write off Rick Perry? He's going to come roaring back?
Well, I know. I'm just saying that at the time, there were all of these smart people who said, oh, that's pathetic. Like Reagan. And the same with George W. Bush. Like, oh, drunk, like totally did it on his dad's name. Weak governor in Texas. Bill Clinton, governor of a small puny state, like last in the country on this, that, and the other measure. Like, that guy's never going to be president. And if he is, he'll be like, so a lot of times these candidates don't fill the office until they fill the office. Oh, and by the way, Barack Obama, one-term senator whose middle name is Hussein, who's never run as much as a lemonade stand in his life, running against Hillary Clinton, like this formidable Democratic powerhouse. Lots of candidates who have gotten the nomination, gone on to be president, and sometimes even been successful presidents have looked like total losers at the beginning. Right. So there's this very weird thing going on. And like even people who are practitioners of this kind of don't allow for that.
I think this is going to be an annus mirabilis for the Republicans because the quality of these people with whom I disagree on virtually everything, but the quality of their minds, their strategic intelligence, their energy, their youth, their vitality, their ambition it's like nothing you've ever seen. Look, it's Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Paul Ryan, Bobby Jindal, Rick Perry, Scott Walker, Chris Christie, Jeb Bush,
Mike Pence,
Rick Santorum, for God's sake.
That's a whole football team.
Yeah.
Go Panthers.
Unbelievable. There's not a dud in that bunch. Any one of those guys could turn out to be, and they are all our guys, could turn out to be an amazing presidential candidate. So I don't see how Romney enters that field with any credibility.
You don't even need to go all the way to the depot with David on that, but you can just say any one of those could be as good a candidate as Romney could be.
Kasich.
And, right. No, I know you. The list goes on and on.
I mean, now the bench.
And the Democrats have like two and a half.
Who's the second?
Martin O'Malley.
Martin O'Malley. That's your shoe?
Oh, I don't. Martin O'Malley, for no other reason than you need a battle. I mean, it'll be really fascinating to see what he does. But, you know, the guy's mayor of Baltimore, governor of Maryland. Like, this isn't like Michelle Bachmann. So, like, somebody who's never run anything. He's got a narrative, but I'm not saying he's, you know, he's running against a pretty massive machine. But I'm just saying, like, he's not a total.
All right. Last question on this topic,
doorstep.
Emily. There's something about the three-time presidential candidate that appears comical in a way the two-time presidential candidate doesn't.
Yeah, it's true. Dewey, Adlai Stevenson.
Harold Stassen.
Reagan, you could argue, was a three-time. And Nixon?
No.
Nixon?
I mean, Nixon.
I guess two.
When was Reagan? What was Reagan?
I can't remember, but I think he flirted in 72 with it. It almost doesn't count, but I think there's a way you can claim Reagan's three. Let me search my recollection.
You know, Winnie, I wonder if there's anyone who's won on a real third candidacy. It does seem comical.
From our reading, the reading that I did last night, that there hasn't been anyone who's won on the third. Listeners should chime in and write to us if we're forgetting someone. I do think there is a way in which it's such a massive mountain of an enterprise to get behind you. The idea that you have enough hubris to say, I've already blown it twice, but I'm the best hope for a third time, that just seems sort of crazy. And I have to say, the ways in which I found Mitt Romney likable in the documentary Mitt, which is helping to fuel this little Mitt bubble, makes me think that he is not self-delusional enough to run again. Like, you have to take away all the things that you found charming about him in that movie and about his family to imagine that he's that big a narcissist.
By the way, Reagan did test the presidential waters in 1968 as a part of a Stop Nixon movement, which is kind of funny.
Okay.
So that's the year. It's not 72, but 68. Also, we need to keep firmly in mind, and we're going to come up with a list when this flirtation period is over, that a lot of these guys who are pretending to run, and Mitt Romney might have a little piece of this too, like, there is no downside to having people talk about you as a possible candidate. I mean, it gets you on boards. It gets you speaking fees. Your speaking fees change by about $50,000. Not that Romney needs it, but the others, if you're considered a candidate or if you're just a has-been, you get to write op-eds. You get to be invited on TV shows. You get invited to fancy weekends in Aspen. Like, you want to be on the list of people who are considered, and you especially want to be on the list of people who can be considered as the, like, smart, reasonable, middle of the road. Oh, right. He's got all these ideas. Right. Wow. You want to be that guy.
That's a good piece. You should write just what it is. What do you get for running? All right. Or for pretending to run, excuse me. Let's move on to our next topic. Greg Orman, who is an independent with lefty leanings, is running maybe even, maybe ahead, maybe a little bit behind Republican Pat Roberts in the Kansas Senate race. Orman is one of those ridiculously wealthy finance guys who decided that he really should be an elected official, and he may well succeed. His strength as a candidate persuaded the Kansas Democratic Party to push their own nominated candidate out the window so that Orman would be alone on the ballot against Roberts. Roberts is a completely, as far as I can tell, dreary senator. I cannot think of – John, no doubt, has things in his pockets that Roberts has done. But really,
well,
it just seems to be
to claim credit for bills that he then voted against. That seems to be one attribute of his.
So he has that is his distinguishing characteristic. But he's pretty consistently conservative. So Orman may be, depending on how the Senate cards fall, if he wins this race, he could be a 50th vote for the Democrats. He could be a 51st vote for the Republicans. Emily, does it matter that it's not really clear what he believes or that he believes anything?
Yes, it matters, but it seems like at the moment it's kind of helping him, because if he defines himself as being too close to the Democrats, in fact, perhaps at all affiliated with the Democrats, then he becomes much more boring and also maybe too liberal for Kansas, which is pretty conservative. So I think it's smart of him not to say who he'll caucus with or even what he thinks about many things. On the other hand, it's kind of embarrassing to imagine we're going to have someone elected to the Senate whose views about some very basic pressing matters are a big question mark.
Well, so he's running on a platform of, like, bringing people together and working out compromise. Like, first of all, that was essentially a version of what the president ran on. And if the president of the United States can't do it, how is, like, a freshman senator from – now, he'll have a certain amount of power because of who he decides to caucus with and how he plays it if he gets elected, depending on what the numbers are. But, of course, not if he's the, like – so say he gets elected and Republicans pick up 7 seats. Who cares about Greg Orman, right? I mean, he can caucus with the Republicans if he wants, but they don't owe their victory to him. And so he'll get some committee assignments and we'll never hear from him again. But the idea that, like, he's going to, like, change things by the power of his own – you know, strengths and is just cockamamie. But you could imagine if we were writing the, like, pilot for the TV series, right, that the guy who tries to stay everywhere at once and just rails against the system, which, by the way, staying everywhere at once and not taking a position is, like, a thoroughly political thing to do and not, although you can turn around and try and make it into, like, a sign of your independence. There is this feeling, A, in the land, and B, among the moneyed classes who are infuriated by the stupidity of the way our government works or doesn't work, as the case may be, and particularly the way the Senate is filled with grandstanders and people don't get anything done, where you could see them like just dumping mountains of money. It's a little too late in this race to do it. But behind such an effort, something that just calls itself independent just to kind of break up the stupidity. In other words, it's so hard to break up the stupidity. Why not? And I'm sort of fantasizing now about the presidential race. If you've got billions of dollars, why not drop $100 million on a candidacy that you're pretty sure is going to lose, but that might just kind of throw a cat amongst the pigeons and shake up the race and get people freaking out and create a sense of serendipity in a process that is so thoroughly like sclerotic and stuck in grooves that like why not spend your money that way?
So gee, I think that's a really compelling campaign slogan. I like now I really want to get out the door and go campaign.
But you just your campaign
Foreman.
Is against the existing stupidity, the system that's rigged on both sides and rigged not just by powerful interests who have the senators and congressmen in their pockets, but also rigged in the sense of it, basically it's pent up by these conventions of timidity and kind of hyper-partisanship. So people hate
But then
that.
You're Ross Perot, except you're a senator, which means that...
No. I'm talking about getting... I'm sorry. I've blown past the reality of the moment.
Okay.
I'm in my sitcom here. No, I'm talking about as a presidential candidate. I mean,
well,
I think what he's
Michael
touching
Bloomberg
on...
Well, fantasy, too.
Yeah, although Bloomberg's not a great vessel for it. But you would need to be... I mean, his checkbook
is
a good vessel.
Well, you have the
David.
Bloomberg model and you have the Ross Perot model. Bloomberg, right. You have the kind of hyper-rationalist robotic genius. And in Perot, you have the lunatic genius. And
right.
You have to pick one of those.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is neither of those two, but an Orman at the national, at the presidential level. In other words, somebody with a great deal of their own money who is kind of a slightly newer generation than Bloomberg.
That is just fantastical.
Well, I'm not saying they would win. I'm saying that they would shake up a system that's basically stuck.
I don't know.
Has this already happened before?
No. I don't mean
that well?
But, sorry, you're not... Ross Perot totally
Ross Perot was
super
successful.
Incredibly disruptive force in that race.
And
I'm only talking about his turn.
He didn't shake up the whole system.
No, but Bill
Clinton.
I actually don't think you're right about that, Emily. Bill Clinton's presidency is in many ways a response to Perotism, and he's a much more conservative and more fiscally kind of responsible president than he probably would have been otherwise.
I think that's
interesting.
I think you can sustain that argument. And I'm making an argument for a disruptive. And I'm dropping that cliche because it's in that lane that
disrupt.
I'm speaking, right? It's something that would shake up the presidential election process. Not somebody who I'm not seeing this person as actually getting into office. I'm seeing them as a person who makes the next year and a half of presidential stupidity on the campaign trail a little less stupid.
But okay, but the actual fact is that we're talking about a Kansas Senate race, and this guy, the idea that you could walk into the Senate and accomplish any of this stuff is ludicrous. It's just silly to think that you are the speeches you're making on the floor of the Senate are going to Mr. Smith goes to Washington style change how politics work.
On the other hand, Orman could get to the Senate and pick up on some particular issue, which will suddenly become his passion. I mean, he did start an alternative energy lighting company. Maybe he'll solve climate change.
He'll bring some illumination to Washington.
Exactly. Well said. All right. Let's leave Orman. Do you think he's going to win, John?
I think that Kansas reverts to form. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I'm too conflicting things. Completely wrecked by Sam Brownback, their governor's
I know, exactly.
tax cuts.
No, I know.
Mean, there
and
really
Brownback
is
may
moment.
Very well lose, and the Democrats, all who turn out for Davis, may go for Orman. So I guess what I'm feeling, because my other thing I was going to say is maybe Orman wins, but it doesn't matter because Republicans take the Senate.
Right.
You can join Angus King over in the corner.
Angus King, who is so independent, he won't endorse him.
I thought he did, no?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, we'll find out. Okay. Let us go to cocktail chatter. When you are getting ready for our live show in San Francisco Saturday night, Emily, having a stiff drink to gird yourself for the show, what are you going to be chattering?
I read Lena Dunham's new book, Not That Kind of Girl, last weekend, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I found it charming and funny and not the voice of the generation as Dunham is made fun of on her show Girls, but a voice I was really interested in hearing from and thought taught me something about what it is like to have just graduated from college or be a very much younger than me woman in the American world right now in a way that I really appreciated. So I recommend it.
All right. I can't wait to read it. Hannah has a copy. I'm going to steal it.
It's good. You'll like it.
I know. I love, God, I love her. I think she's just so fantastic. I wonder if people used to feel this way about Woody Allen. Like, if you talk to our people in our parents' generations, they felt the same warmth and admiration for her, for Woody Allen, that I feel for Lena Dunham, or whether it was always tinged with Woody Allen.
I find the Woody Allen comparison not to be entirely apt, because I think his neuroses have always been creepier.
But did people always feel that way? I wonder. But clearly, retrospectively, they're super creepy.
If you go all the way back to Bananas and Sleeper, maybe not. But once you, and I'm a big Annie Hall and Manhattan fan, but I just feel like Lena Dunham is much more sort of youthful and exuberant.
You're not saying disparaging things about Sleeper, are you?
No. I was saying that was the most charming face of Woody Allen.
Yeah.
A movie, by the way, that one cannot get on Netflix. That's a mystery to me. Mm. My children have not seen it.
All right.
You can't get Sleeper on Netflix?
I can't.
John Dickerson, why don't you chatter?
So my chatter is about something that has come up more and more in conversations I've had with campaign managers of these various campaigns. And it's always existed for the last several cycles, but in this cycle, it seems to come up all the time, which is that a lot of what campaign managers do these days in campaigns is spend their time answering emails with really bad ideas by incredibly wealthy donors to the campaign. So what happens is, I've written a big check to the campaign, or I've gotten all my wealthy friends to write a big check to the campaign, and I've got a lot of ideas about the way things should go down. And those ideas are informed mostly by two things. One, like whatever link I've just seen flash across my eye and whatever my time on the internet is, so I think that the entire world is based on whatever little thing I've seen, or what my spouse is saying. And the one campaign manager in one race basically thought a whole new ad campaign by one of these outside groups. It's in the Colorado race. It was run by Crossroads. It was a group of women standing around the kitchen talking about Mark Udall and how he only talks about women's issues and he should recognize that women care about other things too. A person involved in that race on the Republican side, right, on the side that wants to beat Mark Udall, was like, yeah, that ad campaign looks like a response basically to a donor who said, my wife was saying the other day. So more and more I hear these campaign managers talk about having to basically like spend their time calming down the guys with the money. Some other national Republicans were saying, we're getting all these phone calls from our donors saying, stop talking about the social issues. They're like, we're not talking about the social issues. It's the Democrats who are. The reason this is happening more, I think, two things I put my finger on are, one, there's just a lot more money in politics. You have a lot more people raising money involved in outside super PACs who are just involved in the money raising thing. And part of when you're raising money, you dangle the notion that these people can have a say in the campaign. And then, like, when it comes down to it, they won't have a say in the campaign. The other thing is the proliferation of media, which means that any blog post about any crazy theory can hit one of the inboxes of one of these wealthy donors and excite them and get them on the phone calling you and saying, why don't we run a like Duck Hunters for None campaign, or, why don't we have her in? So anyway, to all of you out there who have run who are running political campaigns, I feel you. I feel for your pain having to answer all those phone calls and spend like hour after hour.
I think most of them are just like, and we really need to talk about charter schools.
Yeah. Well, there's some of that. There's
education reform.
No, a lot of them are like armchair political types who are like, well, why don't we just tell them that Obamacare is bad, or, premiums are going up, or what? Like, they just have some, like, they have a lot of silver bullet theories. If you just run one ad saying that Barack Obama is a socialist, boom, done, it's over, drop the mic, go home.
I want to chatter about just my favorite idea I've heard in a long time. It's something called League of Kitchens. A woman named Lisa Gross in New York has started a business, I guess you would call it, in New York, in which she recruits immigrant women, or not necessarily women, actually, immigrants who are interested in food and cooking, are good cooks themselves and have good command of English, and has them sort of trains them a little bit and has them teach cooking classes and cooking experiences in their own home kitchens. And so you can go to the home of an Afghani woman and she'll cook Afghani food. She'll teach you how to make these great Afghani dishes and talk to you about her life and her own experience as an immigrant. She has, I think she now has about half a dozen or 10 of these programs set up. It seems like such a great idea for connecting with a food culture you're interested in, for making a human connection with somebody and having a food experience that isn't kind of mediated through the grotesque food culture that we live in right now. I love this idea. Should be done elsewhere besides New York. Ms. Bazelon, it is so good to see you again. Mike Volo, the producer, he took a look at your minivan, and we also had our intern, Max Tawney, take a look at it, get under the hood. And, you know, I know that it looks like it's just a flat tire, but I'm sorry to say there's a lot more than that going on here. Can you just take a look at the show page over here? You see slate.com/gabfest. You can see that ball joint there. It's totally rusted out. You can't see it look just behind there. Behind that, see the email address there, gabfest@slate.com. The hydraulics right through there, completely shot. And, you know, that would all be okay. That would be okay, Ms. Bazelon, but the timing belt, see where it says at Slate Gabfest? That needs to be replaced within maybe 5,000 miles or so. It's just going to go. It's just going to go. And Max also noticed that the manifold heat controlling valves right there, look at how black and greasy they are. That's because
what
the hall.
What about John's car?
The hall deck's
clutch. Something wrong with John's car?
Oh, I don't think Mr. Dickerson's car is. He didn't bring it into the shop today. The hall deck's clutch, though, over there at facebook.com/gabfest, also, it's just gone. It's gone. And I showed it to Andy Bowers, who's our executive producer, and he noticed that your evaporative filter, control canister filter, it's expired.
What's that?
Yeah. So here are your choices, Ms. Bazelon. We can fix the flat, and that's fine. You can take your chances. And I just can't guarantee the car is going to get through the next few days. Or we can do the work that you need. So
how much is it going to cost?
I thought you might ask that. It's about $500 for the filter. It's like $720 for the hydraulics, $1,340 for the ball joint. The manifold valves run $225 each. There are two of those. The tire, the clutch, which we're going to have to order special, is about $165. So it's about $3,875 for parts and another $1,200 for labor. But so, but because you've been such a good customer, we can do it an even $5,000.
Hi, to you, the last single listener who's listening to this podcast, we just like to thank you for hanging on.
Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. For Emily and John, I'm David Plotz. We'll be with you next week's our special Superfest West show. Pew, pew, pew.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.